fighting with, you know, some of the biggest companies in the world, some, you know, big countries for supply. And by golly, we got to get out there and fight for this Alaskan project.
Keith Meyer is at the helm as the state takes over the gas line project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the growing cost of insurance in Alaska.
I've had somebody go to tears before because they just simply can't afford it and ended up not being able to get a plan.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
As the state of Alaska takes the lead in the effort to build a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope, it finds itself taking responsibility for what would be one of the largest, most complex projects in the world. The man in charge is Keith Meyer, the new president of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. This week, Alaska's Energy Desk is digging into the pipeline project, its history, current status, and perhaps its future. In part three of our series, Pipeline Promises, Rachel Waldholz introduces us to the man with the plan.
To hear Keith Meyer tell it, this gas line project should not be that hard.
Good morning, everyone.
Back in June, when Meyer was about 2 weeks into his new job as head of the state gas line corporation, he was called up to testify before lawmakers. And he said it's always puzzled him that Alaska's gas line has had so much trouble getting off the ground.
Yes, it's a big project. It's not the biggest pipeline. It's not the highest pipeline. It's not the largest diameter pipeline. It's not the largest LNG plant.
It's not an engineering problem at all, he said.
And on this project, I think where it suffers is not technical complexity. It's the paperwork.
That's right. The project that has eluded the state and some of the world's largest oil companies for some four decades is a paperwork problem. That take left many people wondering, who is this guy?
So I consider myself a gas guy.
Meyer spent 35 years working on pipeline and natural gas projects. He has a vaguely 1950s vibe, salt and pepper hair, hipster glasses. He says things like neat and by golly. He says he's known about the Alaska project since the very first day of his career, back in 1980.
And I remember at that time thinking, as a young buck in the industry, wow, that is a neat project. You know, someday I might get to work on a project like that. So I was thrilled at the opportunity to be the one to bring it home.
And Meyer comes across as supremely confident that he can bring it home. But he inherited a project in flux. Earlier this year, Alaska's three partners, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, told the state they likely wouldn't move the project forward on the expected timeline. The state decided to take over, which puts Meyer in charge. His first task is tackling the project's Achilles heel, its price tag. As he told the legislature,
right now it's high cost. So now our focus has to be on how do we get the cost reduction? How do we get the cost down?
Meyer says that means reimagining the project's financing. The existing project is pretty easy to understand. The state is in a four-way partnership with the oil companies. Each party puts up their $10 to $15 billion and voila, project financed. But with our partners headed for the exits, how does Alaska finance the project on its own? Meyer says we don't have to. He wants the state to quit acting like a deep-pocketed oil major and start acting like a scrappy pipeline company. You don't pay for the project yourself. You bring in outside investors. You put together a deal. That's what he means by paperwork.
So this is significantly different than the way it was done. However, it's very similar to the way most of the pipelines in the U.S. have been built, and also the way most of the LNG facilities now have been built.
Essentially, the state goes out and secures customers. That might be utilities in Japan that want to buy gas. And if the state can sign long-term contracts with those customers, it basically takes those contracts to the bank, using it to secure loans or investors for the first stage of the project. Once construction is underway, other third-party investors might want a piece of it. Pension funds, insurance companies, infrastructure investors. if that all sounds pretty complicated, well, it is. But Meyer has some experience in this. His calling card in the natural gas world is his work on Cheniere Energy's Sabine Pass import terminal in Louisiana. Gregory Zuckerman is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal.
Keith played a huge role in one of the more important players in the this remarkable period for energy for the country and the world. He was part of this effort to import natural gas when it seems like the country needed it.
Zuckerman wrote about Cheniere Energy in his 2013 book, The Frackers. He says Cheniere managed to do pretty much what Meyer's proposing in Alaska. It didn't own any gas, it didn't have deep pockets, but it locked in contracts with big companies that wanted space in its terminal and used those contracts to go out and get financing to build the project. He says Meyer gets part of the credit for that.
He was among the people that made some of the best, concluded some of the best agreements and contracts for Cheniere, according to people close to the matter. So he would be a pretty good person to pull that off. The challenge, obviously, is that these are really expensive projects. And the energy business, as we've learned over the last few years, can change dramatically.
That's what happened to Cheniere. The Sabine Pass project was put together in the mid-2000s when the U.S. thought it was facing an energy shortage. Then the fracking boom swamped the gas market. Cheniere's value plunged. The company only saved itself by turning its import project into an export project. By then, Meyer had left the company. So how similar are these two projects? Well, Sabine Pass was a lot smaller. Kind of like the difference between financing a Kia and a Tesla.
But you've never put together sort of something on this scale in terms of a deal of project financing, you know, in the $40 billion range.
No one has. Right. So I certainly would not claim to either.
Let's just pause for a moment to make sure you caught that. No one has ever put together financing on this scale for a project like this. Meyer says he's under no illusions about the challenges. Alaska's project is big. It's expensive. He's confident there's a growing market for natural gas, but there are a lot of projects competing to fill that space. But he says if we wait, the competition is only going to get worse.
What I really want to see is recognizing that we're fighting with, you know, some of the biggest companies in the world, some, you know, big countries for supply, and by golly, we got to get out there and fight for this Alaskan project.
Keith Meyer, at least, believes it's a fight Alaska can win. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from the skeptics of the governor's gas line plan with the final story in our series, Pipeline Promises. The state's top oil and gas regulator is stepping down. Corey Feige emailed colleagues yesterday saying her last day is October 3rd. Feige didn't return a voicemail seeking comment, but in the email, she says the decision will allow her to spend more time with family. Feige has been the face of an ongoing fight between the state and the oil companies that control Prudhoe Bay over their plans for marketing natural gas from the North Slope. Feige's division wants more specific information from the companies on how they plan to make the gas available. Companies say they either don't have that information or can't legally share it. Alaskans shopping for individual health insurance on the federal exchange will only be able to choose from one insurer when open enrollment starts on November 1st. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska is increasing premiums an average of 7.3%. As Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO reports, state officials are trying to head off bigger price increases in the future.
Juno Montessori school teacher Lori Clark loves working with toddlers, but the 61-year-old is not sure how much longer she can afford to do it. Her job doesn't provide insurance, and she's paying $1,500 per month for individual health insurance, three times what she paid last year in New Mexico.
What choice do I have? I can be uninsured and take a risk of not being able to afford health care or hospitalization or visits to a doctor. I just wasn't, you know, I'm not a risk taker. I don't want to do that.
High insurance premiums are a problem in Alaska. For example, Primera had increases of 37 and 38% the last 2 years. And four companies have dropped out of the insurance exchange, citing an inability to offer competitive premiums that would cover their health costs. There are two reasons. Healthcare just costs more in Alaska than in other states. The other reason is a lot of Alaskans with existing health problems buy plans on the exchange, which is a central feature of the Federal Affordable Care Act. Alaska Division of Insurance Director Lori Wing Heyer says the state government wants to attract more insurers.
It's good for consumers to have a choice so that they can compare plans, compare services, compare the providers, and elect who they want to basically contract their health care insurance with. And at this point in time, consumers in Alaska in the individual market will not be able to do that.
The first step the state took was a law introduced by Governor Bill Walker and passed by the legislature. It provided $55 million in reinsurance to offset Primera's individual insurance costs in 2017 and 2018. Primera estimated it helped lessen its premium increase from nearly 10% to 7.3%. Some legislators say they don't want to pay insurers beyond 2018, so Wing Heyer is looking for a permanent source of funding for individual market reinsurance. A federal innovation waiver could help. Alaska's government plans to apply for the waiver to relax some federal rules regarding reinsurance. Wing Heyer says finding a long-term solution is important.
I think you will see insurance companies look to come to Alaska because they know that those large losses are going to go to the reinsurance program and that there is a way that they can price the insurance where they can at least break even, if not make a small profit.
Primera spokeswoman Melanie Kuhn says the company is committed to Alaska, but she says it will remain a challenge to control premiums without a long-term reinsurance fix.
You're still trying to spread a very large cost across a very small population.
It can be a tough sell. While most Alaskans qualify for federal tax credits that lower their individual insurance premium costs to less than $75 a month, those who don't qualify face high costs. Juneau insurance agent Alan Plotnick of Shattuck & Grumman Insurance says his clients are sometimes shocked by the cost of individual insurance. Some choose to pay a federal penalty of 2.5% of their income instead of buying insurance. Others qualify for a federal hardship exemption from the fee.
I've had somebody go to tears before because they just simply can't afford it and ended up not being able to get a plan. Sure, they can file for the hardship and get an exemption from the fee, but that doesn't help them get a plan and have the peace of mind of having good health insurance coverage.
Lori Clark is one of Plotnick's clients. She says she wants to stay in her teaching job, but she may have to reconsider. She's paying more for insurance each month than for her home.
It's just amazing that all my life I've had health insurance, and I never thought I'd be in this position.
The Division of Insurance is aiming to file for the innovation waiver by October 31st. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, gauging the impacts of climate change on fisheries.
You want to know what Alaska's going to be like 100 years from now? Well, look at Washington, because the temperatures are warmer there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Anchorage didn't experience high winds as predicted last night, but winds up to 70 miles per hour knocked out power to about 33,000 households around the interior, including more than 500 in the Delta Junction area that went without electricity for about 15 hours. Internet and landlines are also out in North Pole, Fairbanks, and Delta Junction. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Golden Valley Electric Association spokeswoman Corrine Bradish says high winds triggered a trifecta of problems Wednesday night that darkened thousands of households in Fairbanks and southward along the Richardson Highway. She says it started with a power failure in south central Alaska at the south end of the big power line called the Intertie that hooks into GVEA's grid.
At 9:14, we lost the intertie, and we also had our battery energy storage system trip offline. And then we had a fault on the transmission line that feeds Delta, and that fault we found out were trees in the line.
Bradish says GVEA restored power to Fairbanks and Healy within minutes for some customers and up to a few hours for others. In Delta, about 500 households went without electricity overnight before it was restored around 12:30 today to almost all of them.
As of 2:40 this afternoon, we still have 25 folks that are out along the Richardson Highway between the Salter River and Midway Lodge. We still have approximately 500 members out in the Delta area.
Some 800 students stayed home today because the Delta Greeley School District canceled classes. Dozens of area businesses that were without power this morning rushed to open their doors when power came back on around lunchtime. A state forestry spokesman says two fires were sparked when trees flopped onto power lines in the Delta area but were quickly extinguished by rural Deltana and forestry firefighters. She says recent rainy weather after a fairly soggy summer has saturated soils throughout the interior, making older, less healthy trees more susceptible to being toppled by strong winds. The blustery conditions are forecast to continue into the evening. The National Weather Service has extended a high wind warning to 10 p.m. for the Alaska Range, from Tulitna in the west to the Canadian border to the east. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
A Puyallup, Washington man is due in U.S. District Court in Anchorage tomorrow to face charges he defrauded several million dollars out of victims in Alaska, money he then gambled away. Floyd J. Mann allegedly ran his elaborate scheme for several years, and many or most of his victims are from Dillingham. KDLG's Dave Benninger has been following the story and joins me now for more. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Lori. Good evening.
So, in broad terms, what do we know about this case and about the charges?
Well, Lori, the FBI, IRS, and Social Security Administration combined their efforts to investigate J. Mann and his wife, Cheryl, there in Washington. He's now been charged with 11 counts of wire fraud and 8 counts of money laundering, and if he's convicted, he could spend up to 20 years in jail, so it's a serious case. She's been charged, Cheryl this is, with defrauding the Social Security Administration for collecting need-based assistance while she allegedly racked up lots of money at this area casino. In broad terms, the feds say the man's gambled some $2.7 million that they had bilked from their victims, and they won at least $1 million along the way that they were gambling there.
Dave, what was Mann's alleged scam, and how did he connect it with these victims in Dillingham?
The connection to Dillingham seems almost random. Just a few doors down in Puyallup lived a brother and sister who are from Dillingham originally. It seems Mann convinced these two and another friend of theirs that he had won two major lawsuits against a Pfizer pharmaceutical company, one of them worth tens of millions and the other worth more than $100 million in settlement. He said that a prescription drug he had been taking had given him cancer, and that's what the lawsuit was about. And once he had a clean bill of health, he stood to collect these massive settlements. So it appears these victims believe they were paying his ongoing medical costs and legal fees. But the feds say none of this was true.
You live in Dillingham. It's not a large community. Do you have a sense of what kind of toll it's taken on the folks who invested in Mann over these years?
We do. People around town have been aware of this for some time, and certainly it's very sad as people are now realizing that this was all a big scam. There were probably more than 15 people who at some point or another invested some into this guy, but it seems that there were probably 10 or less who invested very heavily over the course of about 4 years, and they seem to have lost big time. Some of them have run into financial troubles of their own now. Some have lost property. Some have closed businesses. One person was fired from his employers for suspected embezzlement. The victims are by and large connected through a church, and some of them are related. And again, it's just very sad.
What's known about J. Mann? Does he have a history of schemes and scams or other criminal activity?
Well, it's hard to get a sense of who this guy is. We've been kind of digging around on that for a week or two. In fact, we kind of came aware of this months ago and started trying to figure out who this person was that people were paying down to in Washington. I can say that it doesn't appear he's done this before. There's no criminal record necessarily tying him to any other schemes. He seems to be an out-of-work auto mechanic, auto painter. The Manns have been evicted numerous times around the Puyallup area over the past 10 or 15 years. Interestingly, since we published an article on this case at the beginning of the week, several of his current neighbors have emailed to say that these folks have been a nightmare to live next to. That's their words. One thing that we'll be watching for, of course, is if they are convicted, the feds say they'll attempt to seek restitution for the victims. But I think it's safe to say that's probably trying to squeeze blood from a turnip, so not a lot of hope for relief for the victims in this case.
Jay Mann of Puyallup, Washington, is due in federal court in Anchorage tomorrow. KDLG's Dave Benninger has been following the case. More about this story is available at kdlg.org. Dave, thanks so much for talking to me about this.
Anytime, Lori. Thank you.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The blob is back. The term was coined a few years ago to describe a warm patch of water in the Gulf of Alaska and northern Pacific Ocean. It can turn the weather warm and dry in the state. Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage who closely tracks Alaska climate data and trends. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly for the segment Ask a Climatologist. Brettschneider says earlier this year it looked like the blob was gone, but that wasn't quite right.
It's always been there. It's just been hovering below the surface. So if you looked at surface temperatures, sea surface temperatures, it kind of looked like it was getting back to normal, but all that warmth was just kind of pushed down a little bit, and now it's making its way back to the surface, and it really looks like the blob again.
And when you look at a map of this, it's really striking. Can you kind of describe what that looks like?
Right. So when you look at these maps of sea surface temperatures, the ones that have been released the last few weeks, you just really show this very pronounced warm water anomaly sitting just south of mainland Alaska in the Gulf of Alaska. Of course, the colors they use in the maps for in general for above normal conditions are red. So you've got this kind of red circle sitting below Alaska, and it really does look like a blob.
What effect does this have on Alaska?
When there's warm waters that surround Alaska, it really promotes warmth temperature-wise, surface temperature-wise here in the state. It also affects the upper-level patterns. We generally, the last time the blob was really this pronounced, we had a strong upper-level high pressure that set up, and that really kept us dry. And then to the downstream side of that, in Canada and the northern part of the lower 48, that actually drove their winds, made it come from the north, so it actually made it kind of colder and snowier over there. But over here in our part of the world, it promoted above normal temperatures and below normal precipitation.
And what is the connection between the blob and global warming?
Global warming, I like to say, adds a baseline. It's like a background noise that gets slightly louder every year. But the blob is really is something that sits on top of that. So, for example, at some point in the past, a blob pattern might have only been 2 or 3 degrees above normal, whereas now it's 4, 5, maybe 6 degrees above normal. So it's just something that adds on to the background conditions.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate question for Brian, email akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. With coastlines eroding, temperatures rising, and sea ice retreating, Alaska is feeling the effects of a warming planet. But a new federal report suggests, so far, fisheries in the state haven't experienced many observable impacts of climate change. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more.
Commercial fishing in Alaska is a multi-billion dollar industry. For 18 consecutive years, fishermen have hauled more fish into Dutch Harbor than anywhere else in the country. But at this point, researcher Terry Johnson says climate change isn't a hot topic in the industry.
Now, we're not talking about next year, but we're talking about within this century or within the working lives of young people who are just coming into the fishery now.
Johnson says interest in the topic is growing among fishermen. He isn't a biologist. As a researcher for Sea Grant, an offshoot of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, he synthesized hundreds of scientific papers, interviewed scientists and stakeholders, and combed through popular media to compile this report. Johnson says climate change will have different effects on different fisheries. Some fish like salmon might do better in warmer waters, while pollock and crab might fare worse. Johnson says short-term ocean warming events like El Nino or the blob could preview the long-term effects of climate change on fisheries.
If 50 years from now, the long-term ambient temperatures are the same as they were last year during a short-term event, you can see how stocks reshuffle themselves and some prosper and some diminish.
Johnson says so far observable impacts of long-term climate change on Alaska's fisheries have been relatively mild. Commercially important fish species are prospering, while sport and subsistence resources are within normal ranges. Exceptions like the sweeping decline of Chinook salmon could be tied to climate change or ocean acidification, but the research isn't there yet. And Johnson says seeing Alaska's future is as easy as looking south.
You want to know what Alaska's going to be like 100 years from now? Well, look at Washington, because the temperatures are warmer there. And, you know, if nothing changes, eventually we're going to get a similar kind of long-term temperature increase here.
Johnson says fishermen deal with change all the time. The fishing industry is constantly adapting, from market collapses to advances in technology or shifts in resource management. Johnson says that flexibility has primed them so they can adjust to climate change. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholz, Rasha McChesney and Annie Fite in Anchorage, Dave Bettinger in Dillingham, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message brought to you by Alaska PTAC.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.